So I'll discuss several things other than manganites, and end up with a little bit of cuprates. In the beginning, that I'd like to discuss a bit of a sort of technical advances which made us able to see something which I couldn't see before. And second, we'll concentrate on the issue of charging homogeneity in the cuprates, and then end up with some suggestion of critical issues to theory people. And done with the collaboration with the, let's see, Abby, where the pointer at this one? Oh, no pointer? Oh, thank you. Thank you. My former students, his present student, former student, and my collaborators and Oak Ridge collaborators, Harvey is here. First, we have been sort of looking at this system as not as a perfect periodic system, but a system with some disorder in it. And in this, the conventional technique of diffraction is cumbersome. If you know, a conventional technique focuses on Bragg peak, which represents only the periodic component of the system, and the other aperiodic system component of the system gives a signal in the so-called diffuse scattering, which is not easy to study. So we have been using the technique called paired density function, PDF method. I'll introduce why. And now this PDF range has been extended to 200 angstroms. And also, secondly, that we now can resolve dynamics of this paired density function. And the reason why this approach is useful is, of course, these days nano, you know, range phenomena are very fashionable. But actually, when it comes to nano range phenomena, there aren't too many probes, because most of the probes have been developed for crystals. Right? So long-range structure is easy to determine by diffraction, and also nearest neighbor structure can be determined by NMR or XFs. But when it comes to nano or several tens of angstroms, there's a dearth of techniques. TEM averages over the sample, and STM looks at only the surface. So the bulk nanoscale is the problem. So that's where we come in. So the
TEM would also average when the sample.
Yes, but we don't assume periodicity. Therefore, that you can see the variation in nano range.
TEM
you
also can do. In TEM you also can do variation nano range. But you're doing the scan.
Sorry. Yeah. But I mean, you're averaging over the sample. No. We are averaging paired density, not single density. Okay. TEM averages single density and then takes the correlation. Okay. PDF takes paired density first and then volume average. That's a very, very important difference. Yeah. So what we do is to take a diffraction, but simply apply Fourier transform right away. Then you get an autocorrelation function. In this case, it's atom-atom correlation. This correlation function, so pair density. So that's the nearest neighbor, second nearest neighbor, all that. And this includes no approximation. So this is an example of pure nickel. So you get first neighbor and second nearest neighbor. And this can be completely explained by what we know about the structure and phonons. There have been even some attempts to determine the phonon dispersion from the width. Okay. This is the low temperature data, 10K. So this width is due to the quantum zero point fluctuation. So, and this agrees quite well up, even up to a large distance. So, I published a book recently, setting reasonably well, not as much as Harry Potter's, and maybe six orders of magnitude different.
What's
discrepancy of small q?
Just noise. There's always statistical noise, first of all, and some systematic noise, which we're always working on. But that's the technical details. But I mean, overall, you know, agreement is not bad. Noise goes down like 1 over r. That's why you see more at the lower. Now, the recent change is that we have been sort of focusing on the sharpness of the peak, which is determined by Q range. That's why we use pulsed neutron to get a big momentum transfer range. But we noticed that the Q resolution is also important in getting PDF to long distances, because lousy Q resolution damps PDF, and then that, just like that, you cannot see much. So we got money from NSF and DOE to upgrade one of the fractometer at Los Alamos Lands, and put a lot of detectors to collect backscattering, and it's called NPDF. And with that, we were able to get information in the mid nano range. So an example of application is lithium nickelate. So this is the layered compound, just like that. NiO2 forms triangular lattice and intercalated by lithium. So it is a two-dimensional system. And it's a two-dimensional triangular lattice, a triangular spin system, s equal 1/2. So, you know, it's obvious candidate for RGB and all kinds of behavior. So, and indeed, the magnetic susceptibility shows no transition at all. So this has been very controversial, whether it is really spin liquid or quantum spin liquid or what. Now, I'm not going to get into that today, but an interesting thing is that at the same time, this is in a Yantella system, as Jeff explained earlier. It's the same configuration, except the T2G is filled, but you have EG1. So this is, again, S1/2 Yantella ion. And indeed, sodium nickelate shows a big collective Yantella distortion. Lattice is distorted, indicating Yantella distortion. But lithium nickelate has no indication of Yantella distortion. So the question is why? So what is the role of orbital ordering? And some NMR data shows something, the susceptibility on NMR shows some things happening around 500 Kelvin. So, we took the sample to Los Alamos and look at the PDF altogether. As you can see, we can see easily up to 200 angstroms, okay? That's not noise, because we are showing two temperatures, high temperature and low temperature. And first of all, if you look at the low short distance data, then the first peak is split into two, and that is because of Yantella distortion. In Yantella distortion, this nickel oxygen distance is short and this one is long, and as a result, the nickel oxygen distance is split. So even though the total structure shows no Yantella distortion, the local structure shows clearly Yantella distortion of this type, the same as in manganite. But there's no long range. Yes?
What is
this
meaning? In the first peak, I see the shoulder, that's what I should.
Yeah, that's right, shoulder. That's right. The ratio is 2 to 1, right? 2 long and 4 short. So long one becomes the shoulder, right? That's exactly right. And there's some inversion at the high temperature I'll talk about later. And the reason why this local distortion does not result in a global distortion is this sublattice formation of primer. You know, the Yantella distortion is not collinear, but in three different directions. This is like Yaffet-Kittel solution for this three classical spin problem. And from our diffraction data, that we are able to confirm this.
So when you say no crystal, do you mean
From lattice structure, from you know Bragg peak, position of the Bragg peak, you can determine the lattice, and it is there's no. Yes, that's right. So that should be a you know easy solution that if degeneracy is lifted by this free sublattice structure, but that's not the end of the story. So this shows the temperature dependence of PDF, and it's a bit difficult to see, but at short distance, if you increase temperature because of lattice vibration, maybe I should go back to the earlier one. Yeah, if you increase temperature because of increased lattice vibration, the peak correlation becomes weaker. That peak goes down. That's fine. Yeah, but at long distance, it's the other way around. You know, if you increase the temperature, the peak went up. So my jaw dropped down. This is a bit more careful analysis of the ratio of high to low. This case, you know, many things have almost no change, but here, clearly, it's changing, going to negative. Or that more clearly, that this is the temperature dependence of each PDF peak. So at short distances, the peak height goes down with temperature because of phonon, that's fine. At intermediate distance, like 80 angstroms, not much change. And at, 160, 180, it goes up and then saturates. There's something going on. And actually, there are some subtle change shows up even in S of Q at 375. Very, very subtle change. So what we think is happening is that another level of frustration. We removed this spin frustration, not the spin, the orbital frustration in the beginning, three sublattice formation. But this three sublattice, when we saw from the top, it was like 120 degrees to each other. But actually, in three dimension, it is not. It's making 90 degrees to each other. So it doesn't have inversion symmetry. So it breaks the symmetry of up and down. So as a result, and also that if you repeat this triangular structure, then the mirror symmetry of the plane, not the mirror, but in this case, the inversion symmetry of this plane is broken. So as a result, the plane starts to distort, you know, and therefore that this distortion cannot extend to infinite large distance, and therefore forms domain. And so the domain formation is happening here, and therefore that the size of the domain apparent is probably about this size. So if you go to long distance, then we are looking at inter-domain correlation, which becomes weaker at lower temperature. And so that this temperature of 375 has to be the temperature where that ordering happens and the domains are formed. So anyway, so by this technique, we were able to see this nano size, 8 or 9 nanometer size domain by this real space technique. And
why do you think that something after the domains are getting more correlated?
No. The ordering disappears. The Yantera ordering.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right, exactly. Well, I mean, Yantera distortion exists, but then correlation disappears, yeah? So, Yantera distortion persists up to...
That's right.
Exactly. Next subject I'd like to discuss is the relaxed ferroelectric, which Jeff already has mentioned. And this is an interesting subject and related to many of the, you know, as he said, manganese and cuprates, and it's an interesting subject. Industrially, it is important because, of course, the ferroelectric materials has a high dielectric response, but it is usually, if you have, you know, like barium titanate or something, then response is very strong only near TC. So if you make a device out of that, the device is extremely sensitive to temperature. So the Russian group, Russian people have discovered this so-called relaxer ferroelectric 50 years ago, in which it's like a spin glass, and the transition is rather diffuse. So it maintains high dielectric response over a big temperature range, like 100 K. So it is widely used. But the atomistic mechanism has not been really understood. People have found that something called PNR, polar nanoregions, are formed. Again, nano. And it's even dynamic and etc. And spin glass like freezing of this nano region produces this behavior. But this so-called spin glass like behavior for this material, lead magnesium niobate, it's called PMN, sort of peaks around 230, between 230 and room temperature. But there are some optical method detects something is going on up to 600 K. So, and beyond that, not much is understood for atomic origins. So, anyway, I shouldn't have bothered you with that. So we decided to look at the dynamics of that with the inelastic neutron scattering. But instead of a usual neutron scattering, which, you know, this focuses on dispersion of a particular elementary excitation, this is a highly disordered system, so you don't see anything striking in S of Q itself. So we decided to take a Fourier transform to obtain the dynamic PDF. So measurement is done with the pulse neutron with high scattering, I mean high incident energy, so that we cover big E versus energy versus Q, omega Q space. And then after correction, we get SQ omega and Fourier transform to get dynamic PDF. So that's the machine. We'll be building a bigger one as SNS. Now it takes 2 days, at least 2 days per temperature point at Los Alamos. But the one that we are building at Oak Ridge is at least 20 times stronger, which it helps a lot. So this is the so-called SQ omega, right? So this is the energy transfer. This is a momentum transfer and intensity color-coded. So at low temperature, you don't see much. You don't see even phonons because you know, the system is highly disordered. So instead of focusing, and at high temperatures, you see a little bit more too, but still, you know, a little bit of structure, but not much. So instead of looking at the S of Q directly, we decided to Fourier transform. So of course, S of Q is a Fourier transform of temporary the time-dependent positional correlation. So we simply try to unravel this and to get this temporal correlation. That's the idea. That's the purpose. And S elastic one, omega equals zero, gives you the correlation between the average structure. So that's an obvious crystallographic information. But dynamic one, instantaneous one. If you integrate over the whole energy, then you get an instantaneous correlation function. Yeah, the instantaneous two-body correlation function. And that's a sort of snapshot. X-ray always gets this guy. So, but if you do in between, then you get in between. So you can get frequency dependent correlation functions. So this is just an example of this PMN at 40 K, and the black one is elastic PDF, and the red one is instantaneous. So instantaneous one includes phonon, and phonons are correlated at short distances, it's a little bit sharper. At long distance, they become the same. So this tells you that, you know, at least the results are reasonable, but it doesn't give you any new information. But if you go to 300K, it becomes a bit more interesting, because instantaneous one shows a peak, which is due to lead-oxygen correlation, but the elastic time-averaged one doesn't. So here, there's some indication of nonlinear
behavior.
Yeah, shoulder. That's right.
On the shoulder and the shifted peak.
Right, right. So anyway, that shoulder is because of time averaging is done. Again, you know, elastic case, time averaging is done before correlation is taken. Right? And instantaneous case, you take correlation first and then time average. So that's the difference. Yeah.
So you say that the shoulder and elastic one is the same, they come from the same physics as the peak, except instantaneous somehow brings it out better.
No, time. Well, therefore, that it tells you that this peak is dynamic, right?
Yes.
Dynamics is involved. Others are just phonons. Right? So this cannot be explained by phonons. So now some nonlinear dynamics is involved. I'll show you. Okay. So this is now. This is the real Fourier transform of sq omega. So instead of sq omega, we have omega, and then distance. Okay, this is not q. It's already Fourier transform, right? And the structure of this PMN is perovskite, as Jeff shown. So the Q equal energy zero axis shows the perovskite structure. That's the niobium oxygen distance. That's oxygen and lead oxygen. That's lead niobium distance, and etc. Okay, so that's perfectly cubic perovskite structure along this. Now, this is a lead niobium distance, which is, you know, single peak here. But if you follow this up, it splits into two. Okay, right? That means here you have this double well correlation, niobium lead in the double well situation. So you have dynamic polarization, dynamic, dynamic polarization here. You can see it. And it's happening at a frequency of 15 or 20 millivolt, which is about 5 telehertz. Mm-hmm. So 20 millivolt is 5 telehertz. So that's, yeah. Yeah, T. 10 to the 12. So, and then beyond, you can see this streak, yeah? This is the one that I was talking about, right? So here, this streak ends and sort of distorted and, you know, disappears in time averaged one. But here, it's clearly seen. So this is lead-oxygen correlation. And this lead-oxygen correlation is highly dynamic, at present only above 20 millivolts. Faster, right? And also this one is a part of this. Is long. This is a short lead oxygen distance, and this is long. Long lead oxygen distance is overlapping with this niobium lead. So you know, it's everything's there. You can really see the dynamic correlation in this. So let me show you the temperature. Any question on this? I see this as a future of inelastic neutron scattering. But when you're talking about crystalline, perfect crystalline system, that's fine. But whenever you have deviation from a perfect periodicity, or even in crystals, when you're looking at a very complex system, this is the way to do it. And so we have many applications of this kind of technique in mind.
Wouldn't you see also then if you were to do the inelastic neutron scattering, not PDA, and do this, what you would have to do to reveal the double peak structure as you were double distance?
The point is that if you do inelastic scattering in one baryon zone, you don't see it. Mm-hmm. You have to see many baryon zones over many large momentum transfer. Right? And then you start to see nonlinear effect. Yeah? Looking at one Brillouin zone and is you are assuming linear effect and periodicity, that everything repeats. One Brillouin, you are implicitly assuming one Brillouin zone and next Brillouin zone are the same. Right? Or that there's no structure factor, in complex structure factor involved beyond the unit cell. Right? But that is not the case. So whenever there is a complexity, each Brillouin zone has different information. Right? Of course, you can look at each Brillouin zone and analyze. Of course, no problem at all. But the, yeah.
Split peak in R would imply some beatings in Q space. Right?
That's correct.
But wouldn't I see already?
Of course. But it's not easy to see. I will challenge you if you can see it in the Q space. Of course, I mean, it's just a Fourier transform, right? No. So different representation. But it's easier to see it this way.
That's fine. It's very nice. But the question is whether or not it's just a matter of convenience right now because it's temporal resolution on neutron scattering that is better to do PDF.
Yeah.
Or basically with the INS, et cetera, we would be able to do it even at INS in the current Brillouin zone. You're just saying that
it's the same thing.
Neutron scattering. That's what you said.
Because I challenge you because it's easier to see it this way. It's easier to see.
This method would be good for like localized defects and which have some dynamics.
That's right. Or in between, not completely local, right? That's right. 10 angstrom nanoscale dynamics, local dynamics. That's exactly right. Yeah, if it is extended, excitation, then it shows up in Q space beautifully. But if it is 10 angstrom, overdamped things, it's not easy to see it in Q space because it's broad.
Mm-hmm. So how far in Q do you go? I mean, to degrees?
20 in this case. 20 inverse angstrom.
How robust is this against the sword? It seems like you're going out to very large distances and seeing if you have the sorted system and we can watch that thing.
Yeah, I mean, this nothing. No. No, coherence. No, it's not a Mifflin path question. It's coherence of neutron scattering.
Yeah.
So it depends on. Therefore, we have a trade-off of intensity versus coherence, right? So with SNS, I think we can do better. So for instance, we've done this lead because it's easier. The lance coherence is not that great. So here the change is like 0.3 angstrom, 0.5 angstrom. The difference is big, so we can see it. So we can do this experiment at Los Alamos. Now, what I really wanted to do is to do this for the coupe rates, okay? But for the coupe rates, we need a higher coherence, and we cannot do it at Los Alamos. So we have to wait until SNS is built. So, just like any experiment, it's a question of trade-off, right? So with coupe rate, even at SNS, I will probably have to run like a day or two. Anyway, so that's the idea. So, I like theory guys to think in this real space dynamics, okay? It's easier. It's the same thing, okay? It's just a Fourier transform, nothing to it. But it's easier to think. It's more intuitive.
Yeah. There was a shoulder thing, right?
Yes.
Which then
I'll show you. That's right.
Over time.
That's correct. So, mean is first average over time, and then take a correlation. Right.
And another thing that we've seen then at higher frequencies is kind of a window on time.
Right. So that means that these are developing at this frequency.
But I just was puzzled by it that it keeps kind of dies out if I go to the lower frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So
this one.
Yes.
Right.
No.
This, right. Yeah, this case is that the average distance is this. Lead oxygen average.
Yep.
The average distance of lead oxygen is 2.8, and short 2.45 and the 3.2 are formed. So average distance split into three at high frequency. Yes. But it's well known. Yeah, the lead has this very strange quality of because of this two. So-called lone pair, SP
electron. So, again, shoulder versus the second peak.
Yeah.
Which our position was before
before was kind of at low temperature below the shoulder, at high temperature below the peak, or the other way around. I mean,
so this is the shoulder at the low frequency, and this is the real peak at high frequency.
So the shoulder was basically as you were going at a very low energy. So
yeah, that's right. It's kind of reminiscent, you know, so some hang up. So even at the low frequency, that you know, lead becomes never becomes really isotropic, even after. Anyway, so let me show you the temperature dependence. Then it becomes obvious what the strength is. So I'll show you the temperature dependence of the elastic one here, okay? And this is high temperature. So we go down to low temperature, and then you see that the lead oxygen distance splits even in the elastic channel. And then I'll show you the dynamic one as a function of temperature, right? So the first is the elastic one. So we are looking at, again, time average structure. And it's like a spin glass. So it shows local distortion. This is, again, lead oxygen distance is split into three, right? So the lead is off-centered, even in a time average sense. well, when I say time average, of course, it's a Newton time, so, you know, we're averaging up to 1 terahertz or something, okay? But anyway. So, and this clearly is polarized. Lead is off-centered, okay? And also this lead niobium, also these are off-centered at low temperature.
What is the relationship of this with the previous one?
This is the plot, plot of a low energy portion. Okay? This is the high temperature.
Okay, so basically if I go to the next panel lecture, I should look at the high temperature and see some similar things.
Right, that's right. This should be the, you know, equal zero data of the earlier one. So you just see perovskite structure, right? That's the average lead. Yeah. okay. Anyway, if you look at it, you know, I'll show you later. But anyway, the point is that here you see that the, you know, nearest neighbor and the lead oxygen and all this standard perovskite structure a lot. Huh?
You just made a point about the three split
right.
For lead oxygen distance.
Right. This one. Lead oxygen. So there's only one peak.
No, the lower one, the previous one was three.
And that's at high frequency. Okay?
So the lowest energy there. Yeah, the lowest energy. I think you've got a different.
This is one peak. One peak.
Look at this. One, two.
One, two, three. Right?
Okay.
Now, I should show two, but then one, two, three.
Yeah, this is, by the way, this is low intensity. This is log or direct intensity?
Linear intensity.
Linear?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and this is because average density was subtracted. Yeah. It's so-called G of R, but anyway. It's a deviation from average density.
We all know, actually, that those who work with the color plots, basically, we can convince anybody.
You said it.
That's why I'm asking all this.
Yes. But if you don't have data, you cannot convince anybody either. So. right. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, point is that you know, you can see the split at low temperature, and this kind of disappears at around 300, yeah? 230 to 300. Right? So this is where that the regular RF response of the system, when we measure direct response, then it dies off. Okay, you see only see the dielectric response below this temperature, right? So it kind of agrees with the conventional dielectric measurement and the cubic above. But then if you go to high frequency, this is again 10 to 12 millivolt, so 10 to 20 millivolts, so it's about 5 terahertz. Then you know, these things, this for instance three splits persist all the way. Or that this lead niobium splits persists all the way up to 600. Okay, And this is where the optics see some change. 600 is called Burns temperature. And if you look at some optical reflectivity, you see a change. So this is due to the dynamic polarization of the system. So that's where that sort of a double well develops. Double well system develops. Above that, again, it's average. Right? What we're seeing is dynamic polarization at a frequency of 10 to 20 millivolt. Right? So I think it's the first time that this kind of dynamic local polarization is seen. Right? Extended polarization can be seen, but local one, yeah.
Should we go even to high frequency?
Yeah. No, this above this temperature, I mean, above this frequency, they seem to go together. Oh, I'm sorry. This one is different, right? Actually, this one is the strong lead oxygen bond. So this process at the high temperature and high frequency. You're right. But other than that, this range, everything goes together.
I thought the question was, if you look at this at a different frequency, is this temperature rate disappears the same?
That's correct. So that's what I'm saying. But this one disappears at much higher frequency. Yeah. Anyway, so from this, we learn now that we can really see the dynamic polarization, local polarization, okay? This is not a coherent one. Local polarization. So this is the content of so-called the polar nano regions, right? So nano region dynamics can be seen. So I plan to apply this to other systems, particularly cuprates. So, and this is the best way to see polarons directly, static as well as dynamic polarons. Okay? So that the size effect that I've shown earlier is kind of integrated polaron, PDF polaron. So it's integrated up to about 30 millivolts or something. And probably that's good enough for manganites, but not good enough for cuprates. So my hope is that to use this for cuprates and really see this local behavior.
So how would it look like if I had a polaron? How would the same cut in the sketch look like?
And just like that. Just like that.
As soon as you can excite the electron, you would see a double
well type splitting? That's right. Because inside a polaron, for instance, in simple picture, inside a polaron you have a shorter distance, right?
Yes.
And outside you have a little bit longer distance. Right? There we go. Anyway, so that also that, yes, for you, this is for you to calculate, yeah.
So your picture is basically that the distortion is jumping on, say, between two neighboring.
That's correct.
It's a propagating thing, which...
No. Okay. No. Probably flipping like that. If it is propagating, you see it in SFQ right away. Okay. So the signature in SFQ is weak, but it shows up in the real space. Anyway, so this is just two subjects that I'd like you to be aware that advertisement of upcoming events. And I'd like to briefly, time is running out, so briefly discuss a recent measurement on cuprates in this case. The question of whether, this inhomogeneity that Seamus Davies see. His group C is only surface or bulk, and how common is it going to be? So first is the phono measurement, and I've been doing this for quite some time with Herb, and we focused on in-plane cup oxygen mode. This is the so-called kappa oxygen bond stretching mode. And particularly the zone boundary, so-called half-breathing mode, is an interesting one. The reason is that this mode transfers charge from between oxygen and kappa. So, you know, so this just did tonight, not just, and then we have been doing some exact diagonalization calculation just to show the behavior because this kind of experimental aspect is not necessarily the one that the theoreticians are excited about. So we have to do it ourselves. But to call your attention that this shows this phonon mode induces huge transfer between oxygen and kappa. So this is the effective oxygen charge, so-called. That is that the oxygen nominal charge is minus 2, dotted line, but because of charge transfer, the like a ferroelectrics, the effective there's a negative charge transfer between oxygen and kappa, and essentially that if oxygen goes closer to kappa, the hole gets transferred from oxygen to kappa, and as a result, there's a current opposite to the ionic current, and the ionic polarization is cancelled by electronic polarization. And also that this charge transfer is spin dependent, and even that you know, the magnetic structure factor becomes affected. And this is the calculation of magnetic excitation with and without phonon coupling. So phonon coupling induces strong softening of the magnetic peak, and that is the origin of a slight phenomena. But anyway, so I just wanted to emphasize that this phonon couples even to spin. And also that this phonon essentially modifies T, right? We are modifying the transfer integral by this, so PD transfer by phonon. So as a result, the one phonon part of the conductivity, this is optical conductivity, is affected, but the whole range of optical conductivity is affected. For instance, that's the undoped one, and undoped and doped without phonon, but phonon couples to the mid-gap states. So, and also that my former student Rob McQueeny measured density of states of this LSCO and found that a new peak, phonon peak in DOS appears in a superconducting range, while that is absent in the non-superconducting range. And this density of states corresponds to this half-breathing phonons. So we measured this ISIS, that's the whole part of the data that the ISIS gives, and we measure less. Again, neutron scattering measurement has undergone a big change in the method. It used to be that you know, you count neutron one by one and you plot, right? So you can even plot the peak. In the last case, it's because it's time consuming, so you can plot the peak by hand. You didn't need a computer. But today, that the big system like ISIS measures everything in parallel. You know, there are many detector arrays with time dependence, so that the output of the system is a quarter gigabyte. Okay, so we went from 1 byte to quarter gigabyte in a short time span. So we can process only a part of the information, and. Anyway, okay, I'm running out of time, so let me quickly go. This is the earlier data with Herb. you know, undoped one has a flat dispersion, and the doped one has a strong softening of zone boundary phonon. That is the half-waving mode which showed up in McQueeny's data. Now, that you might think that this softening would be proportional, amount of softening would be proportional to the doping, but it is not. You know, this higher one stays here and lower one stays here. And newer data with ISIS shows the same thing, that, you know, this undoped one has a flat dispersion, And if you dope it, becomes dispersed, yeah, softened. But the amount of softening is the same for the 6.6 and 6.95. And this is a position plot of the position of the zone center and the zone boundary. It just doesn't change. But what changes is intensity. You know, this is the zone center, or high energy portion, not the zone center. High energy portion of the this one coming down, and low energy portion increases. So this you know, speaks of a strong possibility of a phase segregation. You know, so you only have this unsoftened and softened state. Right? I'm not saying that there's a huge phase charge separation, but I mean unsoftened state and softened state. For instance, unsoftened state might correspond to fully AFM order state or something. Okay, but anyway, it's a binary state, unsoftened or softened, and the proportion changes with the doping. And also that this relates to the possibility of a polaron again. Right? Jeff mentioned this, but I believe exactly the same thing, that high temperature state of so-called, you know, strange non-Fermi behavior of cuprates may be very similar to the polaronic phase above TC of manganite. So at going to temperature above 200 K, we detected a mode which is right in between. Okay, at low temperature it's like that, but at high temperature you see a flat dispersionless mode, completely dispersionless mode, and this is the also it's an in-plane mode. It's not an apical oxygen mode. So this is, it looks like that the dispersion has collapsed into local mode, which the polaron would do. And quickly, that we also studied this long-range PDF by this technique. So we can see this, you know, composition dependent. This is the LSCO, and we changed the composition from 0 to 0.3, and did all this many PDFs. So we can see, you know, systematic changes in the peak heights to make the long. Oh, I see. Yes, this is all doping. Okay. Doping of this strontium X. And this is distance. Yeah. So optimal doping is 0.15. Yeah, but that's something that I don't want to know. The strontium position is not interesting. No, strontium seems to be random. Well, I wouldn't say perfect, but I mean, I probe this with X-rays. It's easier to probe with X-rays. It's by diffuse scattering, and it's very weak. So there's no preferential ordering of a strontium. Yeah. Anyway, to make the long story short, that what we see is this kind of thing. So this is a deviation from the perfect lattice, right? So as a function of a doping and a distance. So again, 15 angstrom shows up. So there's some kind of systematic deviation in the superconducting composition, and not just local, but up to 15 angstrom. So you know, again. Heterogeneous, yes. Yes. Overdoped sample is homogeneous.
This is the
low temperature.
Only equals zero. Low frequency.
No, it's integrated.
This is instantaneous.
Well, 30 millivolt. Right, 30 millivolt integrated. Short time integrated.
By looking at it, I can tell immediately that overdoped is homogeneous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, blue one is no deviation. Yeah, that's right. Already above
What is the magnitude there from 0 to 2 to 3? How much is anything linear force? I happen to believe a lot of what you say.
Okay.
But from 0 to 3 when I go, how much real signal change is we have in the data, not in color?
I don't understand. What the percentage wise, you mean?
Yeah, so this is actually something from the PDF.
So it's a deviation.
Yeah, how much we change we have?
It's very small. 5% or something like that. 5 to 10%, yeah. But it's not negligible.
Mm. For instance, if I take the stratum material, like it's 2A, stratum material, like 1A, would I see something profound?
Actually, it's a good question, and the stripe does not change. I hoped the striping would change PDF a lot, but it did not.
Can you see the striping data?
One of them is.
Striping is changing a lot, right? If you
no.
look at along certain directions.
Of course, it does. That's correct. Q space, so you have a peak. But don't forget that what you're seeing is a spin peak. And charge peak is very, very weak, like 10 to minus 6. You can barely see it with X-rays, right?
Well, so insulating material, but some water is talking about the charge order material.
That's right.
Charge order, 10 to minus 6 intensity?
Yeah. Oh, yes, it's very small. And so in PDF, which averages everything, it just hardly changes anything.
So where's the structural transition?
It's about 21%. That's right. It does not. This orthorhombic distortion persists beyond the 21%. That we've shown a long time ago. So locally, everything is orthorhombic, even in tetragonal structure. The amount decreases, okay? But so 21% is like a percolation limit of this local distortion. So locally, 0.21, I mean, this structural transition does nothing. Yeah.
So you would say that it's mostly charge, there's not a spin. That's why we...
Yeah, that's right. It's not a spin. It's mostly charge. It's like high Q behavior. Yeah. So it's... I would say there's no spin component in it. Only charge component. That's what we're looking at.
So the super means whether you have one single peak or two peaks?
No. It's superconducting or not.
Oh.
Yeah, this is done by my Japanese postdoc who aggregates everything.
So it's a 12 angstrom peak. Do you have any feeling what it corresponds to? Any good, like 16% or?
Sorry, 12?
15 and 20 have this peak as about 12 angstroms, right?
I wouldn't put that much faith in it. There's a lot of noises in it. So you should see it with a even more average. I would not put any sort of value to the speak. No, the my message is there's something here. That's all. No. This is a deviation. Okay. Difference between the ideal and the real, and average over distances. Okay, I just wanted to see not the details, but the whole bigger picture. I can give you that, but I mean this gives another message. And also that we are doing some more measurements about direct measurements on the YBCO. But 4.8, which is stoichiometric one, okay? So in this case, there's no doping, stoichiometric, but it's underdoped, and we are seeing some inhomogeneity. We're still making measurements, and we'll finish it in 2 weeks' time. But we're doing Q-dependent Zanes. I don't want to get into this. That takes some time. But anyway, Zanes give you local structure, but only at there's no Q resolution. But by measuring the scattering and then determining so-called anomalous scattering, that we can determine the Q dependence of this local structure. And we see this again at the inhomogeneity of 20 angstroms. So anyway, I ran out of time to go into anything that I wanted to discuss about theory, but So all this tells you, you know, that the inhomogeneity has to be taken seriously. And there's a strong correlation between, I mean, the similarity between manganite physics and cuprate physics and all that, and even the relaxa physics and everything. So there have to be direct links between these different phenomena, and one of them is the polaron widely, you know, broadly defined. Okay, and in this case, polaron does not mean a single site. It's a focal semi-localization, and spin, lattice, everything would help it. You know, if you go a little bit beyond linear physics, of course you start to see localization anyway, all kinds of things. So it's not unnatural, and particularly in cuprates, because of big difference between this pi zero point and pi. You know, dispersions are very different between these two. So my feeling is that that's where the polarons are, and these are free electrons. So naturally leads to this two-component picture. And there are a lot of discussions about this, Kingston stuff like that. But I think they are a little bit missing point. Kings are results of a weak interaction, and it could be due to the spins, this anti-nodal one, a nodal one, probably are phonons, and a nodal one could be spin, but I mean, that's not important. But what's important thing is here, this. It's a little bit just barely seen in YBC, for instance, in anti-nodal case of a bismuth compound, where everybody's looking at this. The lower band, the bonding band of this two-layer system, and that shows, you know, interesting behavior like kinks and Engelsberg-Schwieffer type behavior and all that. That's already a polaron-like behavior. But how about this, upper one, which is right at the Fermi surface, and is completely smeared. So that's I think is the candidate for polaron. And you don't see it. You don't see polaron easily in the photo emission, okay? Because again, we should not rely upon Q space technique too much. Sometimes we should think about real space. So that's my message, more or less.
But what about single layer materials?
Right.
Then we have
that. That's right. That's right. That's why. Oh yes. Yeah, that's why it is more difficult to form polarons, and therefore the TC is lower. That's my opinion. Suggestions. Yeah, I have more, but I mean, I think I have enough. I took enough of your time, so we can discuss individually.
Okay, questions? Or more questions?
I can go more if you like, but anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You showed us a number of different materials.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused about the structural deviations in all of them. You showed us the LCO.
Yeah.
So you're going to look at the 1-4.
Mm-hmm.
You look at 1-3?
Yeah, well, I mean, the phonons are 1-3s.
That's right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's one picture at the end.
Right. That's right. 1-3 is more difficult from that point of view because of issues with the chain. You know, because you are putting oxygen in chain and chain ordering and all that is happening.
Okay, well,
that's why. Oh, 1-4 is perfectly stoichiometric.
So, are you seeing that in your pictures? I understand it's just something you're doing now, but
right. Yes.
So much more homogeneous than LHCO.
No. It's almost the same as YBCO. I think the 1-4-8 does show inhomogeneity, as much inhomogeneity as was 1-3.
Maybe a follow-up on this: if you do NQR,
mm-hmm.
you can look at
that's right. Yeah, but at the NQR frequency.
Yeah.
Of course, of course. Yeah, no question about it.
I think that what you raised the question.
I see what you mean.
They are the same. We just want to know.
I see what you mean.
Prediction or is this?
No. Now I exactly understood. In my view, that inhomogeneity that NMR is seeing for LSCO is irrelevant inhomogeneity. That's because of this strontium, you know, lanthanum substitution is happening very close to kappa, so you see them. But that's irrelevant. And so important. I know. Important question we are asking is that. Is there any inherent intrinsic electronic inhomogeneity exists in cuprates? Okay, so we have to separate that question from ionic inhomogeneity. So magnetic resonance people confuse this all the time, and some say that
how do you separate?
That's a question of technique. I mean, you can do it. It's, you know.
In experiments, when you put strontium, that induces electronic inhomogeneity.
So is it that you look away from those sites? No. I'm not saying electronic inhomogeneity. Strontium ionic inhomogeneity. The randomness of strontium replacing lanthanum changes the local symmetry, and that affects NMR right away. And that is not an interesting. Yeah.
The only charge is coupled to a big gradient.
Of course.
So it is hard to actually untangle these phenomena that I have.
Yeah, if you look at, that's the point. If you look at the NMR alone, it is not easy. Of course. So these days we have to use many, many techniques.
Wonderful, of course, but yeah. I don't see that there's a conclusion that they're doing something wrong.
No. No, experiment is fine, but I mean, if you interpret this.
What you're saying is ionic inhomogeneity does not necessarily imply electronic.
No. The YBCO case that you don't see ionic inhomogeneity because chains away, mm-hmm. right? Chain resonance, chain kappa resonance is easy to separate. So you can just look at kappa, plain kappa. Then you don't see ionic inhomogeneity. So it looks clean, right? But that doesn't mean anything. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so you're saying that in the NMR, they see a combination of the techniques coming from various sources that you by your technique can separate out. That's correct. Yeah, um, more questions, okay, so the you showed this different spectrum. Mm-hmm. Uh, sort of as a fraction of the phonon spectrum.
Huh? Yeah.
How big is that? Is it a percent? A percent? Is it 10%?
Oh, huge. Which one are you talking about? Phonons or?
If you go back to right at the end of the.
This one? Uh-huh. Again, so.
What percentage of the. Well,
yeah, Sasha already asked the question. It's like 5 to 10%, small. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Shemus is like an STM.
Oh, we have YBCO and LSCO. Zone boundary energy is 55 for YBCO and 70 for LSCO. And for BISCO, maybe 60.
If you took the 4% doped sample here as a reference,
uh-huh.
imply that you think this is homogeneous?
No. Yes. There's a bit of a. This is still work in progress, and there's a bit of a problem with the 0%. Because of oxygen, you know, maybe you know that it's not easy to make 0% system because you tend to have too much oxygen.
So you're not making any statement about the homogeneity or inhomogeneity of the 4%.
Yeah, but at 4% you assume to be more homogeneous than than anything else, right? So that's all. Yeah, so also I'm not making quantitative statement, all right? Right. There are similar aspects. Yes. That's why many people working on cuprate went to manganites as a kind of a case study. It's much easier to study. Less frustrating.
That's the point of the workshop.
Yeah. I guess. Thank you. Are there more questions? Otherwise, okay. Let's thank both of people. We